small powder room for the duration of the winter. The crisis had been averted, but bigger questions loomed. How much longer could he continue like this? And at what point would the aches and indignities of old age outstrip the simple contentment he found in each sleepy, lazy day? Chapter 25. Beating the Odds. When school let out for the summer, Jenny packed the kids into the minivan and headed to Boston for a week to visit her sister. I stayed behind to work. That left Marley with no one at home to keep him company and let him out. Of the many little embarrassments old age inflicted on him, the one that seemed to bother him most was the diminished control he had over his bowels. He no longer could go more than a few hours between pit stops. When the urge called, he had to go, and if we were not home to let him out, he had no choice but to go inside. It killed him to do it, and we always knew the second we walked into the house when he had had an accident. Instead of greeting us at the door in his exuberant manner, he would be standing far back in the room, his head hanging nearly to the floor, his tail flat between his legs, the shame radiating off him. We never punished him for it. How could we? He was nearly 13, about as old as Labs got. With Jenny and the kids away, I knew I would be putting in long days. This was my chance to stay out after work, wandering around the region and exploring the towns and neighborhoods I was now writing about. I would be away from home 10 to 12 hours a day. There was no question Marley couldn't be alone that long, or even half that long. We decided to board him at the local kennel we used every summer when we went on vacation. The kennel was attached to a large veterinarian practice that offered professional care, if not the most personal service. Each time we went there, it seemed, we saw a different doctor. We never even learned their names. Unlike our beloved Dr. J in Florida, who knew Marley almost as well as we did, and who truly had become a family friend by the time we left, these were strangers. Competent strangers, but strangers nonetheless. Marley didn't seem to mind. I dropped him off on a Sunday evening and left my cell phone number with the front desk. That Tuesday morning, I was near Independence Hall in downtown Philadelphia when my cell phone rang. It was yet another veterinarian whose name I had never heard before. "We have an emergency with Marley," she said. Marley's stomach had bloated with food, water, and air, and then, stretched and distended, had flipped over on itself, twisting and trapping its contents. With nowhere for the gas and other contents to escape, his stomach had swelled painfully in a life-threatening condition known as gastric dilatation volvulus. It almost always required surgery to correct, she said, and if left untreated could result in death within a few hours. She said she had inserted a tube down his throat and released much of the gas that had built up in his stomach, which relieved the swelling. By manipulating the tube in his stomach, she had worked the twist out of it, or as she put it, unflipped it, and he was now sedated and resting comfortably. "That's a good thing, right?" I asked cautiously. "But only temporary. We got him through the immediate crisis, but once their stomachs twist like that, they almost always will twist again." "Like how almost always?" "I would say he has a 1% chance that it won't flip again," she said. 1%? For God's sakes, I thought, he has better odds of getting into Harvard. 1%? That's it? "I'm sorry. It's very grave." If his stomach did flip again, and she was telling me it was a virtual certainty, we had two choices. The first was to operate on him. She said she would open him up and attach the stomach to the cavity wall with sutures to prevent it from flipping again. "The operation will cost about $2,000, and I have to tell you, it's very invasive. It will be tough going for a dog his age." The recovery would be long and difficult, assuming he made it through the operation at all. Sometimes older dogs like him did not survive the trauma of the surgery, she explained. If he was 4 or 5 years old, I would be saying, by all means, let's operate. But at his age, you have to ask yourself if you really want to put him through that. What's the second option? The second option, she said, hesitating only slightly, would be putting him to sleep. Oh. I was having trouble processing it all. 5 minutes ago, I was walking to the Liberty Bell, assuming Marley was happily relaxing in his kennel run. Now I was being asked to decide whether he should live or die. I had never even heard of the condition she described. Only later would I learn that bloat was fairly common in some breeds of dogs, especially those, such as Marley, with deep, barrel chests. Dogs who scarfed down their entire meal in a few quick gulps, Marley once again, also seemed to be at higher risk. The vet on the phone acknowledged Marley's excitement around the other dogs in the kennel could have brought on the attack. He had gulped down his food as usual and was panting and salivating heavily, worked up by all the other dogs around him. She thought he might have swallowed so much air and saliva that his stomach began to dilate on its long axis, making it vulnerable to twisting. "Can't we just wait and see how he does? Maybe it won't twist again." "That's what we're doing right now, waiting and watching. If his stomach flips again, I'll need you to make a quick decision. We can't let him suffer." "I need to speak with my wife," I told her. "I'll call you back." When Jenny answered her cell phone, she was on a crowded tour boat with the kids in the middle of Boston Harbor. I could hear the boat's engine chugging and the guide's voice booming through a loudspeaker in the background. We had a choppy, awkward conversation over a bad connection. Neither of us could hear the other well. I shouted to try to communicate what we were up against. She was only getting snippets. "Marley, emergency, stomach, surgery, put to sleep." There was silence on the other end. "Hello," I said. "Are you still there?" "I'm here," Jenny said, then went quiet again. We both knew this day would come eventually. We just did not think it would be today. Not with her and the kids out of town where they couldn't even have their goodbyes. Not with me 90 minutes away in downtown Philadelphia with work commitments. By the end of the conversation, through shouts and blurts and pregnant pauses, we decided there was really no decision at all. The vet was right. Marley was fading on all fronts. It would be cruel to put him through a traumatic surgery to simply try to stave off the inevitable. We cannot ignore the high cost either. It seemed obscene, almost immoral, to spend that kind of money on an old dog at the end of his life when there were unwanted dogs put down every day for lack of a home, and more important, children not getting proper medical attention for lack of financial resources. If this was Marley's time, then it was his time, and we would see to it he went out with dignity and without suffering. We knew it was the right thing, yet neither of us was ready to lose him. An hour later, Dr. Hopkinson sounded slightly more optimistic. Marley was still holding his own, resting with an intravenous drip in his front leg. She raised his odds to 5%. "I don't want you to get your hopes up," she said. "He's a very sick dog." The next morning, the doctor sounded brighter still. "He had a good night," she said. When I called back at noon, she had removed the IV from his paw and started him on a slurry of rice and meat. "He's famished," she reported. By the next call, he was up on his feet. "I wouldn't have thought it possible yesterday, but I think you'll be able to take him home tomorrow." The following evening after work, that's just what I did. He looked terrible, weak and skeletal, his eyes milky and crusted with mucus, as if he had been to the other side of death and back, which, in a sense, I guess he had. I must have looked a little ill myself after paying the $800 bill. The doctor said, "The whole staff loves Marley. Everyone was rooting for him." I walked him out to the car, my 99-to-1 odds miracle dog, and said, "Let's get you home where you belong." From now on, he was to receive 4 small meals a day and only limited rations of water, a half cup or so in his bowl at a time. In this way, the doctor hoped, his stomach would stay calm and not bloat and twist again. That night, after I got him home and inside, I spread a sleeping bag on the floor in the family room beside him. He was not up to climbing the stairs to the bedroom, and I didn't have the heart to leave him alone and helpless. I knew he would fret all night if he was not at my side. Tomorrow the house would be loud and boisterous and full of life again, for tonight it was just the two of us, Marley and me. Lying there with him, his smelly breath in my face, I couldn't help thinking of our first night together all those years ago, after I brought him home from the breeder, a tiny puppy whimpering for his mother. I remembered how I dragged his box into the bedroom, and the way we had fallen asleep together, my arm dangling over the side of the bed to comfort him. 13 years later, here we were, still inseparable. I thought about his puppyhood and adolescence, about the shredded couches and eaten mattresses, about the wild walks along the intracoastal and the cheek-to-jowl dances with the stereo blaring. I thought about the swallowed objects and purloined paychecks and sweet moments of canine human empathy. Mostly, I thought about what a good and loyal companion he had been all these years. What a trip it had been. "You really scared me, old man," I whispered as he stretched out beside me and slid his snout beneath my arm to encourage me to keep petting him. "It's good to have you home." We fell asleep together, side by side on the floor, his rump half on my sleeping bag, my arm draped across his back. He woke me once in the night, his shoulders flinching, his paws twitching, little baby barks coming from deep in his throat, more like coughs than anything else. He was dreaming. Dreaming, I imagined, that he was young and strong again, and running like there was no tomorrow. Chapter 26. Borrowed Time. The scare of that summer should have snapped Jenny and me out of our denial about Marley's advancing age, but we quickly returned to the comfortable assumption that the crisis was a one-time fluke, and his eternal march into the sunset could resume once again. Despite all his frailties, he was still the same happy-go-lucky dog. His daily routine included barking at the mailman, visiting the chickens, staring at the bird feeder, and making the rounds of the bathtub faucets to check for any drips of water he could lap up. Several times a day he flipped the lid up on the kitchen trash can to see what goodies he could scavenge. On a daily basis, I continued to pry open his jaws and extract from the roof of his mouth all sorts of flotsam from our daily lives, potato skins and muffin wrappers, discarded Kleenex and dental floss. Even in old age, some things did not change. As September 11th, 2003 approached, I drove across the state to the tiny mining town of Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where United Flight 93 had crashed into an empty field on that infamous morning 2 years earlier amid a passenger uprising. The hijackers who had seized the flight were believed to be heading for Washington, D.C., to crash the plane into the White House or the Capitol, and the passengers who rushed the cockpit almost certainly saved countless lives on the ground. To mark the second anniversary of the attacks, my editors wanted me to visit the site and take my best shot at capturing that sacrifice and the lasting effect it had on the American psyche. I spent the entire day at the crash site, lingering at the impromptu memorial that had risen there. I talked to the steady stream of visitors who showed up to pay their respects, interviewed locals who remembered the force of the explosion, sat with a woman who had lost her daughter in a car accident and who came to the crash site to find solace in communal grief. I documented the many mementos and notes that filled the gravel parking lot. Still, I was not feeling the column. What could I say about this immense tragedy that had not been said already? I went to dinner in town and pored over my notes. After I finished my meatloaf and iced tea, I headed back to the hotel to try to write. Halfway there, on an impulse, I pulled a U-turn and drove back out to the crash site, several miles outside town, arriving just as the sun was slipping behind the hillside and the last few visitors were pulling away. I sat out there alone for a long time as sunset turned to dusk and dusk to night. A sharp wind blew down off the hills, and I pulled my windbreaker tight around me. Towering overhead, a giant American flag snapped in the breeze, its colors glowing almost iridescent in the last smoldering light. Only then did the emotion of this sacred place envelop me, and the magnitude of what happened in the sky above this lonely field begin to sink in. I looked out on the spot where the plane hit the earth, and then up at the flag, and I felt tears stinging my eyes. For the first time in my life, I took the time to count the stripes. 7 red, 6 white. I counted the stars, 50 of them, on a field of blue. It meant more to us now, this American flag. To a new generation, it stood once again for valor and sacrifice. I knew what I needed to write. I shoved my hands into my pockets and walked out to the edge of the gravel lot where I stared into the growing blackness. Standing out there in the dark, I felt many different things. One of them was pride in my fellow Americans, ordinary people who rose to the moment, knowing it was their last. One was humility, for I was alive and untouched by the horrors of that day, free to continue my happy life as a husband and father and writer. In the lonely blackness, I could almost taste the finiteness of life and thus its preciousness. I was reminded of what should be obvious but too often is not, that each day, each hour and minute is worth cherishing. I felt something else as well. An amazement at the boundless capacity of the human heart. At once big enough to absorb a tragedy of this magnitude, yet still find room for the little moments of personal pain and heartache that are part of any life. And in my case, one of those little moments was my failing dog. With a tinge of shame, I realized that even amid the colossus of heartbreak that was Flight 93, I could still feel the sharp pang of the loss I knew was coming. Marley was living on borrowed time, that much was clear. Another health crisis could come any day, and when it did, I would not fight the inevitable. Any invasive medical procedure at this stage in his life would be cruel, something Jenny and I would be doing more for our sake than his. We loved that crazy old dog. Loved him despite everything, or perhaps because of everything. But I could see now the time was near for us to let him go. I got back in the car and returned to my hotel room. The next morning, my column filed, I called home from the hotel. Jenny said, "I just want you to know that Marley really misses you. He's driving us all bonkers." The night before, unable to find me, Marley had paced and sniffed the entire house over and over, she said, poking through every room, looking behind doors and in closets. He struggled to get upstairs, and not finding me there, came back down and began his search all over again. He was really out of sorts, she said. He even braved the steep descent into the basement, where, until the slippery wooden stairs put it off limits to him, Marley had happily kept me company for long hours in my workshop, snoozing at my feet as I built things, the sawdust floating down and covering his fur like a soft snowfall. Once down there, he couldn't get back up the stairs, and he stood yipping and whining until Jenny and the kids came to his rescue, holding him beneath the shoulders and hips and boosting him up step by step. The next morning, Jenny went downstairs to make breakfast. A couple of hours passed before it dawned on her that Marley still had not shown his face, which was highly unusual. She found him sleeping soundly on the floor, tight against my side of the bed. Then she saw why. When she had gotten up, she had inadvertently pushed her pillows, she sleeps with three of them, over to my side of the bed beneath the covers, forming a large lump where I usually slept. With his Mr. Magoo eyesight, Marley could be forgiven for mistaking a pile of feathers for his master. "He absolutely thought you were in there," she said. "I could just tell he did. He was convinced you were sleeping in." Chapter 27. The Big Meadow. Winter arrived early that year. Like the children, I anticipated the first snowfall, but with a quiet sense of dread, wondering how Marley could make it through another tough winter. One blustery Sunday night in mid-December, when the children had finished their homework, Jenny started the popcorn on the stove and declared a family movie night. I got the fire humming as the kids queued up the video. I lay down on the floor and propped my head on a pillow, more watching the fire than the movie. Marley couldn't resist this opportunity. His favorite human was at ground level, utterly defenseless. Soon he was pressed up against me, grinding his head into my ribs. The minute I reached out to pet him, it was all over. He pushed himself up on his paws, shook hard, showering me in loose fur, and stared down at me, his billowing jowls hanging immediately over my face. When I started to laugh, he took this as a green light to advance, and before I quite knew what was happening, he had straddled my chest with his front paws and, in one big free fall, collapsed on top of me in a heap. "Ah!" I screamed under his weight. "Full frontal lab attack!" The kid squealed. Marley could not believe his good fortune. I wasn't even trying to get him off me. He squirmed, he drooled, he licked me all over the face and nuzzled my neck. I could barely breathe under his weight, and after a few minutes, I slid him half off me, where he remained through most of the movie, his head, shoulder, and one paw resting on my chest, the rest of him pressed against my side. I didn't say so to anyone in the room, but I found myself clinging to the moment, knowing there would not be too many more like it. Marley was in the quiet dusk of a long and eventful life. Looking back on it later, I would recognize that night in front of the fire for what it was, our farewell party. 4 days later, we packed the minivan in preparation for a family vacation to Disney World in Florida. It would be the children's first Christmas away from home, and they were wild with excitement. That evening, in preparation for an early morning departure, Jenny delivered Marley to the veterinarian's office, where she had arranged for him to spend our week away in the intensive care unit where the doctors and workers could keep their eyes on him around the clock and where he would not be riled by the other dogs. After his close call on their watch the previous summer, they were happy to give him the Cadillac Digs and extra attention at no extra cost. Ridiculing the whole Disney experience is a favorite sport, but the whole family had a wonderful time, even naysayer Dad. We spent much of the long drive back recounting the pros and cons of each ride, each swim, each moment. We were halfway through Maryland, just 4 hours from home, when my cell phone rang. It was one of the workers from the veterinarian's office. Marley was acting lethargic, she said, and his hips were worse than usual. She said the vet wanted our permission to give him a steroid shot and pain medication. "Sure," I said, "keep him comfortable, and we'd be there to pick him up the next day." When Jenny arrived to take him home the following afternoon, December 29th, Marley looked tired and a little out of sorts, but not visibly ill. But within a half hour of getting him home, he was retching, trying to clear thick mucus from his throat. Jenny let him out into the front yard, and he simply lay on the frozen ground and could not or would not budge. She called me at work in a panic. "I can't get him back inside," she said. "He's lying out there in the cold and he won't get up." I left immediately, and by the time I arrived home 45 minutes later, she had managed to get him to his feet and back into the house. I found him sprawled on the dining room floor, distressed and clearly not himself. I knelt down beside him and rubbed his snout. No reaction. He did not try to gum my wrist, did not want to play, did not even lift his head. His eyes were far away, and his tail lay limp on the floor. After several minutes, Marley slowly stood up on shaky legs and tried to retch again, but nothing would come out. That's when I noticed his stomach. It looked bigger than usual, and it was hard to the touch. My heart sank. I knew what this meant. I called the veterinarian's office. The receptionist said, "The doctor says to bring him right in." Jenny and I did not have to say a word to each other. We both understood that the moment had arrived. We braced the kids, telling them Marley had to go to the hospital, and the doctors were going to try to make him better, but that he was very sick. As I was getting ready to go, I looked in, and Jenny and the kids were huddled around him as he lay on the floor, so clearly in distress, making their goodbyes. They each got to pet him and have a few last moments with him. The children remained bullishly optimistic that this dog, who had been a constant part of their lives, would soon be back, good as new. "Get all better, Marley," Colleen said in her little voice. With Jenny's help, I got him into the back of my car. She gave him a last quick hug, and I drove off, one hand on the wheel and the other stretched behind me so I could stroke his head and shoulders. "Oh, Marley," I just kept saying. In the parking lot of the animal hospital, I helped him out of the car, and he stopped to sniff a tree where the other dogs all pee, still curious despite how ill he felt. I gave him a minute, knowing this might be his last time in his beloved outdoors, then tugged gently at his choker chain and led him into the lobby. Just inside the front door, he decided he had gone far enough and gingerly let himself down on the tile floor. When the techs and I were unable to get him back to his feet, they brought out a stretcher, slid him onto it, and disappeared with him behind the counter, heading for the examining area. A few minutes later, the vet, a young woman I had never met before, came out and led me into an exam room where she put a pair of X-ray films up on a light board. She showed me how his stomach had bloated to twice its normal size. On the film, near where the stomach meets the intestines, she traced two fist-sized dark spots, which she said indicated a twist. Just as with the last time, she said she would sedate him and insert a tube into his stomach to release the gas causing the bloating. She would then use the tube to manually feel for the back of the stomach. "It's a long shot," she said, "but I'm going to try to use the tube to massage his stomach back into place." It was exactly the same 1% gamble Dr. Hopkinson had given over the summer. It had worked once. It could work again. I remained silently optimistic. "Okay," I said. "Please give it your best shot." A half hour later, she emerged with a grim face. She had tried 3 times and was unable to open the blockage. She had given him more sedatives in the hope they might relax his stomach muscles. When none of that worked, she had inserted a catheter through his ribs, a last-ditch attempt to clear the blockage, also without luck. "At this point," she said, "our only real option is to go into surgery." She paused, as if gauging whether I was ready to talk about the inevitable, and then said, "Or the most humane thing might be to put him to sleep." Jenny and I had been through this decision 5 months earlier and had already made the hard choice. My visit to Shanksville had only solidified my resolve not to subject Marley to any more suffering. Yet standing in the waiting room, the hour upon me once again, I stood frozen. The doctor sensed my agony and discussed the complications that could likely be expected in operating on a dog of Marley's age. Another thing troubling her, she said, was a bloody residue that had come out on the catheter, indicating problems with the stomach wall. "Who knows what we might find when we get in there," she said. I told her I wanted to step outside to call my wife. On the cell phone in the parking lot, I told Jenny that they had tried everything short of surgery to no avail. We sat silently on the phone for a long moment before she said, "I love you, John." "I love you too, Jenny." I walked back inside and asked the doctor if I could have a couple of minutes alone with him. She warned me that he was heavily sedated. "Take all the time you need," she said. I found him unconscious on the stretcher, on the floor, an IV shunt in his forearm. I got down on my knees and ran my fingers through his fur the way he liked. I ran my hand down his back. I lifted each floppy ear in my hands, those crazy ears that had caused him so many problems over the years and cost us a king's ransom, and felt their weight. I pulled his lip up and looked at his lousy, worn-out teeth. I picked up a front paw and cupped it in my hand. Then I dropped my forehead against his and sat there for a long time, as if I could telegraph a message through our two skulls, from my brain to his. I wanted to make him understand some things. "You know all that stuff we've always said about you, what a total pain you are? Don't believe it. Don't believe it for a minute, Marley." He needed to know that, and something more, too. There was something I had never told him, that no one ever had. I wanted him to hear it before he went. "Marley," I said, "you are a great doc." I found the doctor waiting at the front counter. "I'm ready," I said. My voice was cracking, which surprised me because I had really believed I'd braced myself months earlier for this moment. I knew if I said another word, I would break down, and so I just nodded and signed as she handed me release forms. When the paperwork was completed, I followed her back to the unconscious Marley, and I knelt in front of him again, my hands cradling his head as she prepared a syringe and inserted it into the shunt. "Are you okay?" she asked. I nodded, and she pushed the plunger. His jaw shuddered ever so slightly. She listened to his heart and said it had slowed way down, but not stopped. He was a big dog. She prepared a second syringe and again pushed the plunger. A minute later, she listened again and said, "He's gone." She left me alone with him, and I gently lifted one of his eyelids. She was right. Marley was gone. I walked out to the front desk and paid the bill. A few minutes later, she and an assistant wheeled out a cart with a large black bag on it and helped me lift it into the back seat. The doctor shook my hand, told me how sorry she was. She had done her best, she said. "It was his time," I said, then thanked her and drove away. In the car on the way home, I started to cry, something I almost never do, not even at funerals. It only lasted a few minutes. By the time I pulled into the driveway, I was dry-eyed again. I left Marley in the car and went inside where Jenny was sitting up waiting. The children were all in bed asleep. We would tell them in the morning. We fell into each other's arms and both started weeping. Later, we went outside and together lifted the heavy black bag out of the car and into the garden cart, which I rolled into the garage for the night. Chapter 28. Beneath the Cherry Trees. Sleep came fitfully that night, and an hour before dawn I slid out of bed and dressed quietly so as not to wake Jenny. In the kitchen I drank a glass of water, coffee could wait, and walked out into a light, slushy drizzle. I grabbed a shovel and pickaxe and walked to the pea patch, which hugged the white pines where Marley had sought potty refuge the previous winter. It was here I had decided to lay him to rest. The temperature was in the mid-30s and the ground blessedly unfrozen. In the half-dark, I began to dig. At the 45-minute mark, I struck water. The hole began to fill and fill. Despite the work I had invested in it, my heart was pounding like I had just run a marathon. I abandoned the location and scouted the yard, stopping where the lawn meets the woods at the bottom of the hill. Between two big native cherry trees, their branches arching above me in the gray light of dawn like an open-air cathedral, I sunk my shovel. These were the same trees Marley and I had narrowly missed on our wild toboggan ride, and I said out loud, "This feels right." Digging went easily, and I soon had an oval hole, roughly 2 by 3 feet around and 4 feet deep. I went inside and found all three kids up, sniffling quietly. Jenny had just told them. Seeing them grieving, their first up-close experience with death deeply affected me. I told them it was okay to cry, and that owning a dog always ended with this sadness, because dogs just don't live as long as people do. I told them how Marley was sleeping when they gave him the shot, and that he didn't feel a thing. He just drifted off and was gone. Colleen was upset that she didn't have a chance to say a real goodbye to him. She thought he would be coming home. I told her I had said goodbye for all of us. Connor, our budding author, showed me something he had made for Marley to go in the grave with him. It was a drawing of a big red heart beneath which he had written, "To Marley, I hope you know how much I loved you all my life. You were always there when I needed you. Through life or death, I will always love you. Your brother, Connor Richard Grogan." Then Colleen drew a picture of a girl with a big yellow dog, and beneath it, with spelling help from her brother, she wrote, "P.S. I will never forget you." I went out alone and wheeled Marley's body down the hill, where I cut an armful of soft pine boughs that I laid on the floor of the hole. I lifted the heavy body bag off the cart and down into the hole as gently as I could, though there was really no graceful way to do it. I got into the hole, opened the bag to see him one last time, and positioned him in a comfortable, natural way, just as he might be lying in front of the fireplace, curled up, head tucked around to his side. "Okay, big guy, this is it," I said. I closed the bag up and returned to the house to get Jenny and the kids. As a family, we walked down to the grave. Connor and Colleen had sealed their notes back to back in a plastic bag, and I placed it right beside Marley's head. Patrick used his jackknife to cut 5 pine boughs, 1 for each of us. 1 by 1, we dropped them in the hole, their scent rising around us. We paused for a moment, then all together, as if we had rehearsed it, said, "Marley, we love you." I picked up the shovel and tossed the first scoop of dirt in. It slapped heavily on the plastic, making an ugly sound, and Jenny began to weep. I kept shoveling. The kids stood watching in silence. When the hole was half filled, I took a break and we all walked up to the house, where we sat around the kitchen table and told funny Marley stories. 1 minute, tears were welling in our eyes. The next, we were laughing. We described all the things he had destroyed and the thousands of dollars he had cost us. We could laugh about it now. To make the kids feel better, I told them something I did not quite believe. "Marley's spirit is up in dog heaven now," I said. "He's in a giant golden meadow, running free, and his hips are good again, and his hearing is back, and his eyesight is sharp, and he has all his teeth. He's back in his prime, chasing rabbits all day long. Jenny added, and having endless screen doors to crash through. The image of him barging his way oafishly through heaven got a laugh out of everyone. The morning was slipping away, and I still needed to go to work. I went back down to his grave alone and finished filling the hole, gently, respectfully, using my boot to tamp down the loose earth. When the hole was flush with the ground, I placed two large rocks from the woods on top of it, then went inside, took a hot shower, and drove to the office. In the days immediately after we buried Marley, the whole family went silent. The animal that was the amusing target of so many hours of conversation and stories over the years had become a taboo topic. We were trying to return our lives to normal, and speaking of him only made it harder. Colleen in particular could not bear to hear his name or see his photo. Tears would well in her eyes, and she would clench her fist and say angrily, "I don't want to talk about him." I resumed my schedule, driving to work, writing my column, coming home again. Every night for 13 years he had waited for me at the door. Walking in now at the end of the day was the most painful part of all. One morning I went to put my shoes on, and inside them, covering the insoles, lay a carpet of Marley fur, picked up by my socks from walking on the floors and gradually deposited inside the shoes. I just sat and looked at it, actually petted it with my two fingers, and smiled. I held it up to show Jenny and said, "We're not getting rid of him that easy." She laughed, but that evening in our bedroom, Jenny, who had not said much all week, blurted out, "I miss him. I mean, I really, really miss him. I ache inside, miss him." "I know," I said. "I do too." I wanted to write a farewell column to Marley, but I was afraid all my emotion would pour out into a gushy, maudlin piece of self-indulgence that would only humiliate me. I knew I wanted to portray him as he was, and not as some impossibly perfect reincarnation of Old Yeller or Rin Tin Tin, as if there were any danger of that. So many people remake their pets in death, turning them into supernatural, noble beasts that in life did everything for their masters except fry eggs for breakfast. I wanted to be honest. Marley was a funny, bigger-than-life pain in the ass who never quite got the hang of the whole chain-of-command thing. Honestly, he might well have been the world's worst-behaved dog, yet he intuitively grasped from the start what it meant to be man's best friend. During the week after his death, I walked around with a dull ache inside. It was actually physical, not unlike a stomach virus. I was lethargic, unmotivated. I couldn't even muster the energy to indulge my hobbies, playing guitar, woodworking, reading. I felt out of sorts, not sure what to do with myself. I ended up going to bed early most nights, at 9:30, 10 o'clock. That weekend, I took a long walk through the woods, and by the time I arrived at work on Monday, I knew what I wanted to say about the dog that touched my life, the one I would never forget. I began the column by describing my walk down the hill with the shovel at dawn, and how odd it was to be outdoors without Marley, who for 13 years had made it his business to be at my side for any excursion. "And now, here I was alone," I wrote, "digging him this hole." I gave a lot of thought to how I should describe him, and this is what I settled on. No one ever called him a great dog, or even a good dog. He was as wild as a banshee and as strong as a bull. He crashed joyously through life with a gusto most often associated with natural disasters. He's the only dog I've ever known to get expelled from obedience school. I continued. Marley was a chewer of couches, a slasher of screens, a slinger of drool, a tipper of trash cans. As for brains, let me just say, he chased his tail till the day he died, apparently convinced he was on the verge of a major canine breakthrough. There was more to him than that, however, and I described his intuition and empathy, his gentleness with children, his pure heart. What I really wanted to say was how this animal had touched our souls and taught us some of the most important lessons of our lives. A person can learn a lot from a dog, even a loopy one like ours, I wrote. Marley taught me about living each day with unbridled exuberance and joy, about seizing the moment and following your heart. He taught me to appreciate the simple things. A walk in the woods, a fresh snowfall, a nap in a shaft of winter sunlight. And as he grew old and achy, he taught me about optimism in the face of adversity. Mostly, he taught me about friendship and selflessness, and above all else, unwavering loyalty. It was an amazing concept that I was only now, in the wake of his death, fully absorbing. Marley as mentor, as teacher and role model. Was it possible for a dog, any dog, but especially a nutty, wildly uncontrollable one like ours, to point humans to the things that really mattered in life? I believed it was. Loyalty, courage, devotion, simplicity, joy, and the things that did not matter, too. A dog has no use for fancy cars or big homes or designer clothes. Status symbols mean nothing to him. A waterlogged stick will do just fine. A dog judges others not by their color or creed or class, but by who they are inside. A dog doesn't care if you are rich or poor, educated or illiterate, clever or dull. Give him your heart, and he will give you his. It was really quite simple, and yet we humans, so much wiser and more sophisticated, have always had trouble figuring out what really counts and what does not. As I wrote that farewell column to Marley, I realized it was all right there in front of us, if only we opened our eyes. Sometimes it took a dog with bad breath, worse manners, and pure intentions to help us see. I finished my column, turned it in to my editor, and drove home for the night, feeling somehow lighter, almost buoyant, as though a weight I did not even know I had been carrying was lifted from me. Chapter 29. The Bad Dog Club. When I arrived at work the next morning, the red message light on my telephone was blinking. I punched in my access code and received a recorded warning I had never heard before. "Your mailbox is full," the voice said. "Please delete all unneeded messages." I logged onto my computer and opened my email. Same story. The opening screen was filled with new messages, and so was the next screen, and the one after that, and after that too. The morning email was a ritual for me, a visceral, if inexact, barometer of the impact that day's column had made. Some columns brought as few as 5 or 10 responses, and on those days I knew I had not connected. Others brought several dozen, a good day. A few brought even more. But this morning there were hundreds, far more than anything I had received before. The headers at the top of the email said things like, "Deepest condolences," "About your loss," or simply, "Marley." Animal lovers are a special breed of human, generous of spirit, full of empathy, perhaps a little prone to sentimentality, and with hearts as big as a cloudless sky. Most who wrote and called simply wanted to express their sympathies, to tell me they too had been down this road and knew what my family was going through. Others had dogs whose lives were drawing to their inevitable ends. They dreaded what they knew was coming, just as we had dreaded it, too. One couple wrote, "We fully understand, and we mourn for your loss of Marley, and for our loss of Rusty. They'll always be missed, never truly replaced. From Connie. It's just the most amazing thing to love a dog, isn't it? It makes our relationships with people seem as boring as a bowl of oatmeal. When the messages finally stopped coming several days later, I counted them up. Nearly 800 people, animal lovers all, had been moved to contact me. It was an incredible outpouring, and what a catharsis it was for me. By the time I had plowed through them all and answered as many as I could, I felt better, as though I was part of a giant cyber support group. My private morning had become a public therapy session, and in this crowd there was no shame in admitting a real, piercing grief for something as seemingly inconsequential as an old smelly dog. My correspondents wrote and called for another reason, too. They wanted to dispute the central premise of my report, the part in which I insisted Marley was the world's worst-behaved animal. "Excuse me," the typical response went, "but yours couldn't have been the world's worst dog, because mine was." To make their case, they regaled me with detailed accounts of their pet's woeful behavior. I heard about shredded curtains, stolen lingerie, devoured birthday cakes, trashed auto interiors, great escapes, even a swallowed diamond engagement ring, which made Marley's taste for gold chains seem positively lowbrow by comparison. My inbox resembled a television talk show, Bad Dogs and the People Who Love Them, with the willing victims lining up to proudly brag not about how wonderful their dogs were, but about just how awful. Oddly enough, most of the horror stories involved large, loopy retrievers, just like mine. We weren't alone after all. Larry the Lab swallowed his mistress's bra and then burped it up in one piece 10 days later. Gypsy, another lab with adventurous taste, devoured a jealousy window. Jason, a retriever Irish setter mix, downed a 5-foot vacuum cleaner hose, interior reinforcing wire and all, his owner Mike reported, adding, "But I loved that beast." Phoebe, a lab mix, was kicked out of 2 different boarding kennels and told never to return, owner Amy wrote. It seems she was the gang leader in breaking out of not only her cage, but doing the favor for 2 other dogs, too. They then helped themselves to all kinds of snacks during the overnight hours. Tim reported his yellow lab, Ralph, was every bit as much a food thief as Marley, only smarter. One day before going out, Tim placed a large chocolate centerpiece on top of the refrigerator, where it would be safely out of Ralph's reach. The dog, his owner reported, pawed open the cupboard drawers, then used them as stairs to climb onto the counter, where he could balance on his hind legs and reach the chocolate, which was gone without a trace when his master returned home. Despite the chocolate overdose, Ralph showed no ill effects. Another time, Tim wrote, Ralph opened the refrigerator and emptied its contents, including things in jars. Nancy clipped my column to save because Marley reminded her so much of her retriever, Gracie. I left the article on the kitchen table and turned to put away the scissors, Nancy wrote. When I turned back, sure enough, Gracie had eaten the column. Wow, I was feeling better by the minute. Marley no longer sounded all that terrible. If nothing else, he certainly had plenty of company in the Bad Dog Club. I brought several of the messages home to share with Jenny, who laughed for the first time since Marley's death. My new friends in the secret brotherhood of dysfunctional dog owners had helped us more than they ever would know. The days turned into weeks, and winter melted into spring. Daffodils pushed up through the earth and bloomed around Marley's grave. Gradually, life without our dog became more comfortable. Days would float by without me even thinking of him, and then some little cue, one of his hairs on my sweater, the rattle of his choker chain as I reached into my drawer for a pair of socks, would bring him abruptly back. As time passed, the recollections were more pleasant than painful. Long-forgotten moments flashed in my head with vivid clarity, like clips being rerun from old home videos. The way Lisa, the stabbing victim, had leaned over and kissed Marley on the snout after she got out of the hospital. The way he held mangoes in his front paws as he nibbled out the flesh. The way he snapped at the baby's diapers with that look of narcotic bliss on his face. Little moments hardly worth remembering, and yet here they were, randomly playing out on my mental movie screen at the least likely times and places. Most of them made me smile. A few made me bite my lip and pause. He was a central player in some of the happiest chapters of our lives. Chapters of young love and new beginnings, of budding careers and tiny babies, of heady successes and crushing disappointments, of discovery and freedom and self-realization. He came into our lives just as we were trying to figure out what they would become. He joined us as we grappled with what every couple must eventually confront, the sometimes painful process of forging from two distinct pasts one shared future. He became part of our melded fabric, a tightly woven and inseparable strand in the weave that was us. Just as we had helped shape him into the family pet he would become, he helped to shape us as well, as a couple, as parents, as animal lovers, as adults. Despite everything, all the disappointments and unmet expectations, Marley had given us a gift at once priceless and free. He taught us the art of unqualified love, how to give it, how to accept it. Where there is that, most of the other pieces fall into place. No doubt about it, life without a dog was easier and immensely simpler. We could take a weekend jaunt without arranging boarding. We could go out to dinner without worrying what family heirloom was in jeopardy. The kids could eat without having to guard their plates. The trash can didn't have to go up on the kitchen counter when we left. Once again, we could sit back and enjoy in peace the wondrous show of a good lightning storm. I especially liked the freedom of moving around the house without a giant yellow magnet glued to my heels. Still, as a family, we were not quite whole. One morning in late summer, I came down for breakfast, and Jenny handed me a section of the newspaper folded over to expose an inside page. "You're not going to believe this," she said. Once a week, our local paper featured a dog from a rescue shelter that needed a home. The profile always featured a photograph of the dog, its name, and a brief description, written as if the dog were speaking in the first person, making its own best case. It was a gimmick the shelter people used to make the animals seem charming and adorable. We always found the doggy resumes amusing, if for no other reason than the effort made to put the best shine on unwanted animals that had already struck out at least once. On this day, staring up from the page at me was a face I instantly recognized. Our Marley. Or at least the dog that could have been his identical twin. He was a big male yellow lab with an anvil head, furrowed brow, and floppy ears cocked back at a comical angle. He stared directly into the camera lens with a quivering intensity that made you just know that seconds after the picture was snapped, he had knocked the photographer to the ground and tried to swallow the camera. Beneath the photo was the name Lucky. I read his sales pitch aloud. "Full of zip. I would do well in a home that is quiet while I am learning how to control my energy level. I have not had an easy life, so my new family will need to be patient with me and continue to teach me my doggy manners." "My God," I exclaimed, "it's him. He's back from the dead." "Reincarnation," Jenny said. "Full of zip? Problem controlling energy? Working on doggy manners? Patience required?" We were well familiar with those euphemisms, having used them ourselves. Our mentally unbalanced dog was back, young and strong again, and wilder than ever. We both stood there staring at the newspaper, not saying anything. "I guess we could go look at him," I finally said. "Just for the fun of it," Jenny added. "Right, just out of curiosity." "What's the harm of looking?" "No harm at all," I agreed. "Well then," she said, "why not? What do we have to lose?"
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.